It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. In this hour, pranks and hoaxes. We'll hear from a master of the artful hoax.
So I took the marketing, the merchandising of death to the ultimate extreme, and I created a Disneyland for the Dead theme park.
And writer Walter Kern shares his story of being duped by a dangerous con man.
I finally felt what I had felt underneath and had covered up the whole time I was with him, which was fear.
From mischief makers to imposters, today we'll explore the art of fooling others. We all have a bit of the trickster in us. Even if you've never played a practical joke on someone, you've probably laughed at a few. But pranks aren't just for April Fool's Day. They can be powerful vehicles for political and social change. Kembrew McLeod is a performance artist who pulls politically charged pranks. He's also a professor at the University of Iowa, and he's just come out with A History of Pranking, which goes all the way back to one of America's founding fathers, Ben Franklin.
Over the course of his life, he used over 100 different pseudonyms that he would use for satirical op-ed pieces. In fact, soon before he died, I think about a month or so before he died, he pulled what I considered probably the best prank of his life, in which he was satirizing and critiquing the biblical justifications used to uphold slavery. And so he wrote a satirical editorial about how Muslims should enslave Christians because European Christians are the real savages. That's an example of using mass media, the major medium of its time, the newspapers, to stir up a public debate about something that was very important.
So you're basically interested in pranks that have some social or political value, that are kind of like satirical performance art.
Yeah. A good prank is one that uses media to stir up a public conversation about important social issues, as opposed to a hoax, which is a publicity stunt, or even a con, where the point is to use deception to take people's money or possessions or whatever. And so, yeah, I'm most interested in thinking about how pranks can be used to make people sharper, critical thinkers.
Well, there's such a long history, especially in the 1960s, of pranks as a way of speaking truth to power. I mean, most famously, I guess, Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters.
Yeah, Ken Kesey, the author, he basically consolidated a group of people in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, that became known as the Merry Pranksters. And in many ways, they were kind of pranking reality. You know, for me, a prank basically turns the world askew, even if it's just for a moment. And when you do that, you can see the world from a new perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I think Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters, they were doing these essentially rolling performance art pieces in their road trip across America, where they painted school bus with a swirl of colors and tricked it out with amplification and tape loops and echo effects and so on, so that when they would roll through a small town in middle America with this weird bus and weird sounds coming from it, I sort of see that as a prank on reality.
But in that same era spawned, I'm thinking about some of the political things. Like, didn't Abbie Hoffman famously tried to levitate the Pentagon?
Yeah, Abbie Hoffman and Paul Krassner, they actually applied for a permit to levitate the Pentagon 20 feet in the air. And they actually met with Pentagon officials and eventually agreed on a compromise, which was they could levitate it 3 feet in the air.
But what was the point of that?
The point of that was just, A, just to have fun, but B, they were using that as advertising for a big anti-war rally that was happening at the same time. So in other words, they were basically in a pre-internet age trying to make this meme go viral.
From that period, what do you think were some of the most politically effective pranks that were pulled?
I think one of my favorite, because it's so simple, was when Abbie Hoffman and other yuppies went to the New York Stock Exchange and dumped a big garbage bag full of dollar bills, I think about $300 or $400 worth, over the heads of the stock traders. It stopped trading for a few minutes. It stopped the ticker while these buttoned-down businessmen suddenly started diving for dollars. And what I think that prank did really nicely and effectively was that it sort of lifted the veil of respectability and showed the kind of naked greed that lay underneath the stock exchange. The interesting thing about pranks to me is that they're very performative, and they also it also kind of breaks down the barriers between actor and audience. So in this case, Abbie Hoffman basically turned this audience into performers when they dropped what they were doing and started grabbing cash on the ground because traders had never seen like the
money floating
rain
down
from the sky.
And so much more effective than just marching around the front of the stock exchange with placards.
Yeah, and they made sure that reporters also came along so that it would be reported on. Media is a key part of pranking, in my opinion.
The great ones kind of take on a life of their own. I mean, sometimes mm-hmm. there are pranks that start, essentially they're rumors that then become urban legends. Mm-hmm. I mean, you trace the prank origins of, there was a famous urban legend that smoking banana peels can get you high.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember hearing that just through word of mouth when I was in, you know, high school in the late 80s. But it started out essentially as a word of mouth prank amongst friends in the West Coast. The most likely culprits were the leaders of this hippie band, Country Joe and the Fish. And they started circulating just because they thought it would be funny, circulating this rumor amongst their friends that smoking banana peels would get you high. And then it eventually cropped up in underground newspapers in the early, like in early 1967. And then just coincidentally, around the same time, Donovan had the hit Mellow Yellow.
Was that really about banana peels?
No. And it turns out that the song, I found when I did more research, the song was written way before that rumor started circulating. It was just this cosmic coincidence. And so so underground papers picked it up, and then fairly quickly, regional newspapers like the San Francisco Chronicle and then Time and Newsweek and national media. And it was funny because there was a congressperson who responded in a very ironic way by introducing a bill called the Banana Enforcement Act of 1967, in which he read the speech on the floor of Congress. Anyway, the FDA actually responded very soberly with a press release after analyzing the chemical elements of banana peels and said that there were no hallucinogenic effects. But it just took on a life of its own. You know, it just kept circulating through word of mouth and off and on in mass media for years.
Who are your favorite pranksters?
I don't know. I have a lot of them. I think I have a soft spot for Alan and Jean Abel. They're this married couple that have been going at it for over 50 years. And in the late 50s, they created a fictitious society for indecency to naked animals, or CINNA.
What was it?
Yeah. It was an organization that advocated clothing naked animals because, you know, little children shouldn't be able to see animal genitalia. They were sending up 1950s American morality.
They
were satirizing
values.
It by claiming, you need to clothe your animals because we have genitalia surrounding us all the time, right?
I can't believe you didn't mention the Yes Men.
Oh, yeah. The Yes Men also. They're probably the best and my favorite contemporary pranksters. So, for instance, they created a fake website, a fake Dow Chemical website that claimed that the Dow Chemical subsidiary Union Carbide, which famously like 25 years ago accidentally leaked chemicals in India, killing a lot of people and causing lots of long-term damage to the environment as well as health risks.
This is a famous chemical leak in Bhopal.
Bhopal, yeah, in the early 1980s. And so the Yes Men decided to use the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal chemical spill to announce that Dow Chemical was selling off Union Carbide and using all the money generated from that sale to compensate victims. They were invited on BBC World News, where a quote-unquote Dow Chemical representative who is actually a Yes Man confirmed that, yes, Dow Chemical is selling off Union Carbide, and they apologizing for, you know, acquiring Union Carbide in the first place, and that they would compensate the victims. And basically,
so how did Dow react?
Well, Dow immediately sent out a press release saying that this is fake, but not before the Dow stock crashed by, I think, $2 billion or so. It eventually recovered. But that's an example of pranksters using mass media as a megaphone to amplify their criticisms of, in this case, corporations that engage in unethical behaviors.
How have pranks changed in the age of social media?
Well, I think it's allowed some pranks to go viral much more quickly than they had in previous years. So Jimmy Kimmel can post a YouTube video of a woman twerking and then catching herself on fire by falling over into a coffee table with a candle, and it goes viral almost immediately. And so, yeah, social media has allowed some kinds of pranks to circulate much more quickly. But the flip side of that also is that it also increases the speed at which pranks and hoaxes can be debunked, because there are plenty of blogs out there and websites out there like Snopes. And so, yeah, pranks can be revealed much more quickly.
So the prank is alive and well.
Yeah, it's not going away. We might have reached a saturation point, but they're not going to go quietly into history.
Kimbrew, thanks so much for talking.
Oh, thank you.
Kimbrew MacLeod is the author of Pranksters, Making Mischief in the Modern World. One of the best-known contemporary pranksters is a guy named Joey Skaggs, the original culture jammer. He's been pulling elaborate and successful media hoaxes since the mid-60s. For instance, he started the National April Fool's Day Parade, which has been going for 30 years now. The trick is, it never happens. Joey told Steve Paulson he started pulling pranks because he wanted to be an artist.
I came to realize that the business of art is that. It is a business, and it is the antithesis of the creative process. Creating art is really the pleasure that I get, not dealing with the politics and the marketing and the sales of art. So I realized early on that there was a big difference, and that most people don't take young artists too seriously. You may be driving a cab next week or whatever, and I didn't want to wait for someone else to give me approval, so I wanted to do things that I thought would not be received by the political gallery scene. And I spoke out against hypocrisy as I self-righteously perceived it, and I found myself, you know, getting arrested and also making news headlines.
So you wanted to do more than just, I don't know, paint a pretty picture. You wanted a response. You were a provocateur in some way.
True, but, you know, art is many things to many people. To me, it's, you know, coming up with, it's communicating. And so I watched how the media twisted and torqued the intent, the content, the meaning of the message, and I realized that if one is to communicate, the most powerful medium there is for communicating is the media. So instead of just asking the media to come to my exhibitions, I decided to use the media itself as a medium, and I started creating things with the media. Social, political, satirical performances that were either ironic reversals or a juxtaposition of reality or a direct political statement. And then I started incorporating hoaxes into my repertoire.
So part of your whole concept of a successful hoax is, well, something obviously that fools a lot of people, but also that gets picked up by the media. I mean, to some degree, it's a commentary on the media itself.
Well, actually, it works on a number of levels. It has to be picked up by the media. A hoax is only a hoax if you fool someone else, so you're not fooling yourself. That's a whole other issue. But a hoax, to be successful, has to fool someone, and that's the nature of it. That's only the first part of doing it. Underneath the hoax are issues. So I use the media only as a tool, as a vehicle, to get messages out to people. I'm trying to change memes, you know, how people think, what they believe, why they believe it, why they are so convinced that it's true. Do they ever question these beliefs? And so I reconstruct realities. There's an element of plausibility, but there are always social, political issues underneath the joke. That's my art.
One of your more recent media hoaxes was something called The Final Curtain, which you did, I believe, in the year 2000. Can you tell me about this?
Well, The Final Curtain, we all have to die sometime, and it's an issue we all have to, you know, face if we haven't already faced it to some degree. So I took the marketing, the merchandising of death to the ultimate extreme, and I created a cemetery, theme park, mall, timeshare program for the deceased, artists creating their own monuments, and made it, you know, just a totally absurd Disneyland for the dead theme park, and succeeded in fooling AP and Fox Network and many, many, many TV, radio, and news journalists.
Now, obviously, part of your goal is to fool the media, but with a hoax like The Final Curtain, were you trying to make some statement about death as well?
Well, absolutely. All my hoaxes have statements as part of the hoax. If you look at the nature of what it is that I do, there are always social, political, satirical commentaries in all the hoaxes.
So what was your point with The Final Curtain?
Well, it's you know, how we've marketed and merchandised the death industry. And I just took it to an extreme.
You're basically saying that the death industry, the whole business of funeral homes and burials and cremations, is there's something scandalous about it.
I would say so.
So was this a success? Is the mark of success if you fool a bunch of people?
Well, I think that I measure my success differently from the way success is usually registered. A success is you get a good review and you sell the piece. I have nothing to sell, so I'm not producing art that is a viable commercial commodity. My art is a concept, and I get to have a lot of people share that concept and that process. So I measure success by, firstly, coming up with an idea that pleases me, secondly, executing it and fooling the media, thirdly, watching how it all gets, you know, recorded, and then revealing it, and then seeing what happens when I reveal the truth, and there is success in that aspect as well.
One of your most successful hoaxes was one that you did back in 1976, the cat house for dogs. Tell me about that one.
Well, I placed an ad in the Village Voice which read cat house for dogs, featuring a savory selection of hot bitches from Pedigree, Fifi the French Poodle, to Mutz, Lady the Tramp, handler and vet on duty, stud and photo service available, no weirdos please, dogs only, by appointment, and my phone number. And along with a press release that said, you know, if your dog has graduated obedience school, or if it's his birthday, or if you're embarrassed to come home finding him humping on a pillow, or if you were fearful of having a party because your dog would mount your company's legs, since there are cemeteries for dogs and restaurants for dogs and clothing stores for dogs and all of the amenities in life that a dog would enjoy, except for one, now for the first time you can get your dog sexually gratified. And I said I had a drug called estradiol, which artificially induces a state of heat into the females who would only naturally come into heat every 6 months. And if we had a female dog who was in a natural state of heat, we would give her a contraceptive called Overban so that you or your dog wouldn't have to worry about having a litter of puppies, as this is not a breeding service. This is purely a sexual pleasure service. And for $50, you can make Fido a very happy dog. And I was going to franchise this, and I had bumper stickers which read, "Get a little tail for your dog." And I just put this out, and I had a tape recorder, you know, on my answering machine. And when I was not home, the message was, you know, "Thank you for calling Cat House for Dogs. Leave a message, and we'll get back to you." When I was home and I answered the phone, I recorded all the phone conversations. And there were people who wanted to get their dogs sexually gratified, wanted to be sexually gratified themselves, wanted to watch other people getting sexually gratified. And it, you know, sort of like opened the closet door, and all kinds of things that I didn't even expect started pouring out. And, of course, it morally outraged a large segment of the population.
Including animal lovers, I bet.
Yes, and the NYPD Vice Squad and the Bureau of Animal Affairs and various religious and humane organizations who were totally offended that I was a dog pimp and that these poor dogs didn't have anything, any choice in the matter. And, you know, big dogs were humping on little dogs, and this is totally outrageous. So they launched a campaign in the media to put me out of business and to have me arrested. And I was subpoenaed by the Attorney General of the state of New York for illegally operating a whorehouse for dogs, for which there was no law, but they had to bust me for something. So they said they couldn't find that my veterinarian was licensed in the state of New York, and I may be treating these dogs inhumanely, caging them up with too many dogs in a cage or whatever. And they busted me, and this is after WABC Television in New York did a documentary on the cat house for dogs.
Which was actually nominated for an Emmy.
Well, you know what?
It?
What happened was, and this is really interesting, ABC, the 2020 producer, contacted the department that gives out the Emmys and found out, for all these years, I thought that they were only nominated. The producer actually received an Emmy.
Hmm.
And
did the producer ever give it back?
Absolutely not, because her career is based on the fact that she got an Emmy. She claimed, and still does, that I'm only saying that I was doing a hoax to avoid prosecution. This is how we want to, you know, con ourselves. You know, that's why it's so easy to perpetrate hoaxes. We are so, you know, conditioned to lying to ourselves and to being lied to. And that's part of what it is that I do. I'm just trying to, you know, rock the boat, rock the status quo, make us question our beliefs, and to perhaps come to a different concept about the way things really are.
That was the internationally notorious multimedia performance artist and prankster, Joey Skaggs, talking with Steve Paulson. Coming up, when does a hoax cross the line into betrayal? or even crime. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge, and this hour we're talking about pranks and hoaxes.
He was an artful liar, it was true, and he had tried to be an artful murderer, but he wasn't a real artist, and he knew it.
That's Walter Kern, reading from his new memoir, Blood Will Out.
Clark loved to talk, but had nothing much to say, nothing of his own, which was surely another reason that he lied and plagiarized lies and recycled his old lies. He had 10,000 ways to tell you nothing. I felt like I'd heard all of them.
Walter Kern's book follows his friendship, and ultimately his deception, by a con man who posed as a wealthy eccentric named Clark Rockefeller. They were friends for 10 years before Kern uncovered the truth, that the man he knew as Clark Rockefeller was in fact a serial liar and murderer. Producer Doug Gordon got the backstory.
Walter, this all started back in the summer of 1998 with a disabled dog, a Gordon Setter named Shelby. What happened?
Okay, in 1998 in the summer, the Livingston, Montana Humane Society got in a dog that couldn't walk. It had been run over by a car, and it needed the assistance of a wheelchair. It was, you know, a dog that needed a special owner who could pay a lot of attention to it. So they put it up for adoption on the internet and got a response from New York City from a fellow who called himself Clark Rockefeller saying, I'd love to take care of this dog. I have another Gordon Setter. I have a private chef who gives my dogs four-course meals. I, in fact, live next door to Tony Bennett, who serenades my dogs sometimes. But there's one problem. I don't drive, so I can't come pick it up. And my private jet's in China with my wife. So what are we going to do?
Yeah.
They came to me and they said, you lived on the East Coast. Maybe you can talk to this Rockefeller character. And once I talked to him and realized what an eccentric he was, I made the decision to drive the dog myself from Montana in my pickup truck to Central Park South, or near there, in New York City.
Now, you didn't end up driving the dog all the way to New York City, and your mother, of course, had something to do with this. You stopped to visit her in Minnesota at the time, and you ended up flying the rest of the way. So tell me about your first meeting with Clark Rockefeller when you arrived at LaGuardia Airport.
Yeah, so I had a nervous breakdown, couldn't drive anymore in Minnesota, flew in to LaGuardia at night with the dog for the last leg. Clark Rockefeller had told me I'd recognize him because he was a dead ringer for the character of Niles on the show Frasier. And I looked around, and first I couldn't see him because he wasn't as tall as Niles, but then there was a guy in a pink polo shirt and a pink cap and loafers without socks, and he had this funny accent that I recognized from the phone, and he said, hello, Walter, you know, thank you, thank you. That's where the friendship began.
Can you give me an example of one of the most eccentric things that at the time you found charming?
Well, you know, charming or just interesting. He once said to me early on, I've never tasted a Coca-Cola, Walter. What does it taste like? You know, and my answer was brown and very sweet.
Yeah.
He said he'd never eaten in a restaurant. He told me that he'd gone to Yale when he was 14. His parents were dead, and he was kind of a child prodigy. He claimed that he was doing research into speed of light or beyond speed of light interstellar propulsion systems at a secret lab in Canada. And he showed me kind of a picture of the lab. It was really just a picture of a forest. And in the trees, he said, was the lab hidden from satellite.
And how did you discover that Clark Rockefeller was not who he said he was?
Well, in 2008, I'm in Montana working in my office, and I see on the internet that there's a nationwide Amber Alert. Clark Rockefeller is a wanted man. He's kidnapped his daughter from a street in downtown Boston after a custody hearing, and he has disappeared. I had been talking to Clark over the last year about his grief, or anger is a better word, at having lost custody of his daughter in a divorce. And because I was divorced too and didn't see my kids as much as I liked, we comforted each other on this subject. When I saw that he'd kidnapped her, I thought, oh my Lord, he snapped. And though it was appalling, I kind of understood the level of emotion that might lead to it. A few days later, it came out that the Rockefellers were saying, he's not one of us. And I thought the Rockefellers were lying. But then it came out he was also a suspect in a murder from 1985, a gruesome, violent murder in California. And when I heard the details of the murder, for various reasons, I knew he was both guilty of it, and I knew I had been not just fooled, but in danger the whole time I'd known him.
Wow. So how did that make you feel when you came to that realization?
It was like walking out and looking at the sun and then having a big hand reach through the sky and rip it open, and you realize it's all a painting of the sky and the sun isn't real. I mean, it was like tumbling through space. I thought, my goodness, I can't trust my own judgment at all. And that was really hard on me. I mean, everything that's easy about social life suddenly became hard because I suddenly realized everything's based on trust.
Mm. Did writing this book help you exercise the self-doubts, the low self-esteem, or are you still struggling with these issues?
This book helped me in this sense. When I finished it, I finally felt what I had felt underneath and had covered up the whole time I was with him, which was fear. Fear of his disapproval. Fear at some level of what I subconsciously knew maybe was his violent nature, fear of him ridiculing me. Once I wrote the book, I realized that once I gave him the power of believing that he was, you know, sort of from a better social class and all these things, I had feared rejection by him, and I was no longer afraid of it. Now I court his rejection. I know he loathes me, and the feeling's mutual.
Yeah. You attended his murder trial. Can you tell me about that, what it was like to sit in the same courtroom?
Yeah. So in 2013, exactly a year ago, I'm sitting in a downtown Los Angeles courtroom, probably about 10 feet from him. His lawyers asked the judge if they would address him and refer to him as Mr. Rockefeller during the trial, even though that wasn't his name. It was Christian Karl Gerhardsreiter, his original German name.
Yeah. He was originally from Germany, wasn't he?
He was originally from Germany. He'd come over to the U.S. at 17 and started posing as, a fancy guy. Anyway, he dressed in a blue blazer and loafers without socks, and he dressed as this fake Rockefeller. After he was convicted, when he came in to be sentenced, of course, he was back in his orange prison jumpsuit. So it was really something to see someone who I had thought was such a, highfalutin character walk in with handcuffs in a orange prison uniform.
You visited him in jail. This was after the trial or during the trial?
He was arrested for the kidnapping in 2008. And as of 2013, he'd been in jail the whole time and had never spoken to the press, never spoken to anyone. But the minute he was convicted, he fired his lawyers, and I found out that I was free to go visit him in prison, and so I did, and I resumed our relationship in prison.
Mm-hmm. You also asked him what the key was to manipulating people. What did he tell you?
Yeah, I said, well, if you're not going to confess to the murder, at least tell me this. How do you con people? How do you fool people? How do you take advantage? And he said, it's three simple words, all the same word, vanity, vanity, vanity. You play on people's vanity.
Hmm. In hearing your story, I can't help but think of Janet Malcolm's famous book, The Journalist and the Murderer. And in that book, Malcolm describes the journalist as a kind of confidence man preying on people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse. Do you think that's what was going on with you and Clark, or were the roles possibly reversed?
Well, it wasn't really what was going on at first. You know, when I got to New York after having decided I had to meet him because it would make a great story, I quickly decided I was not going to write about him. He was a real person. He valued his privacy. It wasn't fair to break the confidence of a friendship. When I found out that he wasn't Clark Rockefeller and was indeed a murderer, all of that went by the wayside, and I thought, I am going to put this down in a book. I am going to lose my shyness. I am going to tell everything I know about my relationship with him. And I felt liberated by that. So for a while, I was being a very good, polite human being, but I stopped being one when I found out that he was a monster.
Huh. Yeah. Your whole experience raises the question, can you ever really know another person?
You can know a person to the extent to which that person is knowable. You can't know a sociopath. You can't know a psychopath because there's nothing to know about them. They assemble their personality in order to manipulate others. They create appearances, but beneath the appearances is nothing but their will to power, to take advantage, sometimes their will to cruelly hurt others. So you can know another person, but you cannot know a psychopath. There's nothing there.
Walter Kern, talking with Doug Gordon about his new memoir, Blood Will Out. You can hear their complete, unedited conversation on our website at ttbook.org. And now the story of another appalling hoax, this one from the early 19th century. Legendary showman P.T. Barnum, the founder of Barnum and Bailey's Circus, once owned and exhibited a slave named Joyce Heth. Barnum claimed she was 161 years old and had once been George Washington's nanny. Benjamin Reese tells the story in his book, The Showman and the Slave.
She really had no other choice but to perform this role. She told stories about Washington's hatred of the Redcoats. She sang hymns that she had supposedly taught him. She sometimes made fun of her visitors. You know, somebody would criticize her and she would say, "I'm not half as ugly as you are." She never could have protested against the conditions of her labor. I don't think such a thing ever could have quite presented itself to her. I believe that she was originally a slave on the plantation of a Heth family that lived first in Virginia in the 18th century and then had a branch that moved out to Kentucky. The Heth family is an interesting family. William Heth was a captain in the Revolutionary War who fought alongside George Washington, and he left behind a diary in which, for a several-year period, there's practically never an entry in which he doesn't in some way mention that he has this special connection to George Washington. You can imagine this William Heth kind of holding forth on the plantation to visitors about the great man. And I think you can also imagine if there's a slave woman with a certain amount of histrionic talent and a satirical eye picking up on this story and beginning to twist it a little bit, possibly to her master's face for a bit of ribbing, or maybe with a kind of sharper edge to slaves in the back quarters, saying, you know, "Well, he says he dined with Washington. Well, I diapered him." And I think that's the point at which the story begins to take off. One interesting thing about the story she told, though, is that she apparently had no knowledge of what became of Washington. P. people would ask her, you know, what do you think of his political career? And she would say, I don't know anything about that. In fact, she didn't know that Andrew Jackson was president. And this was a part of, I think, what made the story kind of gratifying for white visitors, and they were pretty much all white, was to get this sense of a black woman who had been at this intimate moment in the story of the nation, and yet she herself didn't understand its significance in the way that they all did. So there was a way in which I think the audience was gratified by this, her exclusion from her own story.
That was Benjamin Reese on The Life of Joyce Heth, with sound design by Joe Hartke. Reese is the author of The Showman and the Slave, Race, Death, and Memory in Barnum's America. And a quick postscript to the story, after Joyce Heth died, Barnum arranged a public autopsy to prove that she was really 161 years old, which is where his hoax fell apart. The doctor said she couldn't have been more than 80. And that wraps up our discussion on pranks and hoaxes. When we come back, we'll get the story behind the new Hollywood blockbuster Noah. Well, not exactly the movie, but how Noah's flood became a pillar of modern creationist thought. And writer Cheryl Strayed shares a favorite book. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild, and the book I recommend is a memoir by the writer Poe Ballantyne called Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. In it, Poe chronicles his life in the small town that he lives in Nebraska, his marriage at this very sort of tumultuous time in his personal life, against really the backdrop of something that happens in this town. And that is one day a math professor who lives, you know, just down the street from Poe is found horribly murdered, or he's committed suicide. That's uncertain. That's the mystery of the book. He's tied to a fence post a few miles outside of town, and it seems that he's been burned. And Poe really does this amazing thing where he bridges these two stories, this unraveling mystery of what happened to this, by all accounts, gentle soul, this math professor, and what happens to Poe in his life as a father and a husband during these years. Of course, this story about the math professor is very compelling and mysterious, but I think that really the deepest part of the book for me is the way that he writes so honestly about his wife and his marriage. He really does get inside of what it's like to be involved with someone so deeply. They're raising a child together, and we all know what a challenge that can be, and how he can love his wife so deeply that he's committed his life to her, and also hate her at the same time. And he writes about that place and intimacy where love and hate reside so closely together, And he says some things that just astonish me. And so there's a scene where he's talking about a fight they're in, and what he reveals about his own motivations and impulses and feelings in the heat of that rage are just stunning. It's one of those reads. I just couldn't put the book down. I read it on a flight. I was flying from London back to Portland, Oregon, where I live. And I was grateful for that long flight because I read every page and couldn't be released from the book until I had.
Writer Cheryl Strayed recommends Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere by Poe Ballantyne. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week we're thinking about Hollywood's new blockbuster, Noah.
Noah, what did he say?
He's going to destroy the world.
Remember, Noah, he chose you for a reason.
Darren Aronofsky's new film about Noah and the Ark is already generating controversy among religious believers. Some Islamic countries have banned the movie, and many Christians are also taking a long, hard look, although the Vatican has reportedly given its blessing. One reason the movie's getting so much buzz is that Noah's flood is a pivotal event in the creationist explanation for the origins of life. To find out why, Steve Paulson caught up with the leading historian of creationism, Ronald Numbers, to talk about flood geology and modern creationism.
There's a stereotype that creationists just aren't that smart. I mean, how can you ignore the steady accumulation of scientific knowledge that has shown overwhelming support for evolution? Is this a question of intelligence or of education?
Not fundamentally. There is a slight skewing of anti-evolutionists toward lower levels of education, but it's not huge. They're really dumb creationists, and they're really dumb evolutionists. Of the 10 founders of the Creation Research Society, 5 of them had earned doctorates in the biological sciences from major universities. Another had a PhD from Berkeley in biochemistry. And these were not dumb, uneducated people. They were individuals who rejected evolution for religious and, they would say, for scientific reasons.
And yet that's so hard to understand for people who aren't religious. I mean, if you go through the university system, get a graduate degree in the biological sciences, how can you still allow religion to trump science?
They wouldn't see it quite that way. Most people who reject evolution do not see themselves as being anti-scientific in any way. During the 1920s, the primary argument was to say that evolution did not deserve the name of science. It was too speculative. It was too theoretical. They loved science. By the 1960s and 70s, the anti-evolutionist had shifted considerably, and the hardest core of them were arguing creationism is scientific. We're advocating creation science.
Given your field of study, you have a particularly interesting personal history. You grew up in a family of Seventh-day Adventists, right?
That's correct. All my male relatives, I believe, were ministers of one kind or another. Both my grandfathers, my father, all my uncles on both sides worked for the church. My brother-in-law is a minister. My nephew is a minister.
So you went through Adventist schools.
First grade through college.
Through college.
I graduated from Southern Missionary College in Tennessee.
And what did you think about the story of life's origins as you were growing up?
I was never exposed to anything other than what we now call young earth creationism. Creation science, as you may know, came out of Seventh-day Adventism. My father was a believer. All my teachers were believers. All my friends believed in that. I can remember as a college student, I majored in math and physics, and there was a visiting professor from the University of Chicago lecturing on carbon 14 dating, and he was talking about scores of thousands of years, and my friends and I just looked at each other wincing and smiling, and he didn't know any better. Here he was, a prominent astrophysicist from a major university, and he just didn't know the truth.
But at some point, your ideas obviously changed. What caused you to start to question the creationist account?
I wish I knew. There are a few moments that I can identify that proved crucial for me. One was I went to Berkeley in the 60s as a graduate student in history and learned to read critically. Also, I was exposed to critiques of young earth creationism, and the one that stands out in my memory as being decisive was hearing a lecture about the fossil forest of Yellowstone given by a creationist who had just been out there to visit and found that of the 30 or so successive layers, assuming the most rapid rates of decomposition of lava into soil and the most rapid rates of growth for the trees who came back in that area, you needed at least, say, 20,000 to 30,000 years. And the only alternative that the creationists had to offer for that was that during the year of Noah's flood, these whole stands of trees came floating in, one on top of another, until you had about 30 stacked up. And that truly seemed incredible to me.
So your beliefs kind of came crashing down at that moment.
Well, the night after I heard that, I stayed up till very, very late with a fellow Adventist graduate student friend of mine, wrestling with the implications of this. And before dawn, we both decided that the evidence was too strong.
What are your religious beliefs now?
I don't have any.
Are you an atheist?
I don't think so. I think that's a belief, that there's no God. So I think the term agnostic would be best for me.
You mentioned that Seventh-day Adventism actually played a crucial role in the history of creationism. An early Adventist laid out the whole idea of flood geology, didn't he?
Exactly. George McCready Price, he was a very smart person, and he wrote a whole library shelf full of books. Price came along in the early 20th century and made the flood the key actor in the history of life on Earth. That is, you have an original creation. It's supernatural. You can't find any evidence of that. But you can study the fossil record. And he tried to show that the entire geological column could have been deposited in about 1 year. And that became the centerpiece of what he called the new catastrophism. And then in about 1970, that view, flood geology, the new catastrophism, was renamed creation science or scientific creationism.
But this is a fascinating history, because you're saying that this whole idea of flood geology was really laid out by George McCready Price in the 1920s.
Correct.
And then it kind of disappeared, or it sort of went underground, and then it was revived again in the 1960s.
In the early 60s, two fundamentalists, a theologian named John Whitcomb Jr. and a hydraulic engineer named Henry Morris, took Price's flood geology, reworked it a little bit, and published it as The Genesis Flood. Notice the seminal books in the history of creationism have focused on geology and the flood, not so much on biology. And as a result of what Whitcomb and Morris did, Price's views exploded among fundamentalists and other conservative Christians.
But why? I mean, why did this view, which on the surface seems kind of outlandish,
yes,
the idea that Noah's flood would have somehow resolved all of the contradictions within the fossil record, why would that suddenly explode in popularity in the 1960s?
And especially when fundamentalists had two perfectly orthodox interpretations of Genesis 1 that would have allowed them to accept all the paleontological evidence. One was that the days of Genesis represented vast geological epochs, or cosmic epochs even. William Jennings Bryan accepted that. The founder of the World's Christian Fundamentalists Association accepted that.
So in that account, you could have the Earth going back billions of years.
Time was no problem. And another view, very popular among fundamentalists, was called the gap theory. That is, that after the original creation in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, Moses, the author of Genesis, skipped in silence a vast period of Earth history before coming to the Edenic creation in 6 days associated with Adam and Eve. So you had these perfectly good interpretations of Genesis available to fundamentalists, which makes your question all the more difficult to answer. Why would they turn their backs at the very time that more and more fundamentalists are becoming educated in the sciences and accept this radical theory that everything was created only about 6,000-7,000 years ago.
Okay, well, I'm willing to bet that you have some explanation here.
The biggest explanation, I think, is that for 100 and some years, Christians had been reinterpreting God's sacred word, the Bible, in the light of new scientific discoveries. And people like Whitcomb and Morris, the authors of the Genesis flood, struck a really sensitive chord when they said, it's time to quit interpreting God in the light of science and start with God's revealed word and then see if there's any model of Earth history that will fit with that.
Because otherwise, science keeps chipping away.
Exactly. At it religion. Never ends. It always changes, and it means you're going to have to constantly be reinterpreting God. And it wasn't so much that they invested in the Genesis account as that many of them were concerned about the last book of the Bible, Revelation, which foretold the end of the world. And they would argue, how can we expect people, Christians, to believe in the prophecies of Revelation about end times, which were so near and crucial, when we symbolically interpret Genesis and interpret it away? For many of these people, they felt that if you want people to take Revelation seriously, you have to get them to take Genesis really seriously.
Now, one thing I find curious about your position in all of this is, I mean, you are generally acknowledged to have written the history of creationism, your book, The Creationists. You've been very upfront about your own lack of religious belief. And yet, as far as I can tell, you seem to be held in high regard by both the creationists and by scientists, which I have to say is a neat trick. How have you managed this?
In terms of getting along well with critics of evolution, I haven't gone out of my way to attack them or to ridicule them. I know some of the people I've written about. They're good people. Some of them are smarter than I am, not a particularly high standard. But I know that it's not because they're stupid that they're creationists. I'm talking about all my family, too, who are still creationists. So that easy explanation that so many anti-creationists use, that they're just illiterate hillbillies, doesn't have any appeal for me.
University of Wisconsin historian Ron Numbers is the author of the book The Creationists, and he spoke with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show. He had help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Stephanie Youngblood, and Joe Hartke. Our theme music was composed by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Gurill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.